But today is VE Day. The war is
the newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to The Wealth Show, where we discuss the key topics shaping the wealth management industry and investors' portfolios. I'm Sophie Downs and I'm joined today by Patrick Farrell, Chief Investment Officer at Raymond James. Welcome, Pat.
Thank you, Sophie.
So before we dive into the granular details of asset allocation, I'm sure our listeners would be keen to hear about the ongoing integration of Charles Stanley into Raymond James. So you served as Charles Stanley CIO for 4 years?
Yes, that's right.
Can you walk us through the recent changes to the investment team now that the integration is nearing completion?
Yeah, I think what we had before was a really capable, well-respected research team that was serving our wealth manager network. But we also had an external-facing asset management team. And I think some of the sort of benefits that come out of some of the recent changes is that we've been able to just merge those two central teams together. And so, you know, we've got a stronger research capability, we've got a stronger asset allocation capability going forward that then translates into all the portfolios that we manage. And I think one of the sort of key objectives for us is to really try to leverage as much as we can a lot of the investment insight that we generate within the research and the asset management capability together, and just combine it into an overall CIO office. So from that sort of perspective, it's working out really, really well. You know, we've got some really strong caliber in terms of the voice that we are putting out there to our clients in particular, but also to the broader marketplace. So, you know, on that basis, you know, we've been able to reflect those positions in our portfolios. We've been able to explain to clients right across our whole group, right across the whole Raymond James group, including into the US and into Canada, in terms of what our thoughts are in terms of the developments in the Middle East, what's happening on the AI front, and all of our thoughts in terms of what that portfolio strategy needs to look like.
And by merging them, have you changed the process at all, or has it been more about kind of that streamlining, bringing it together?
We were very, very close before with a few sort of minor changes. And I think where we've got to is we've just been able to align things a lot stronger and, you know, really promote that from an external voice perspective. So even though the portfolios were very, very similar in terms of the approaches and the asset allocation capabilities, now we're completely aligned. And so a lot of the sort of thought processes that we come up with, the insights, how do we reflect them into our client portfolios? And there are different elements to that, because an MPS is different from an OEIC, you know, and it's different from also the sort of model portfolios, the guidance portfolios that we provide to our wealth manager networks, because they all implement slightly differently. And so we've got to be very conscious about, you know, how we get some of these positions in play. But we all want to reflect some of these sort of key positions as we sort of go through. This market environment is extremely uncertain. And so making sure that we've got some of those sort of key elements in every portfolio that we look after is so important.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so we last spoke in mid-April and talking about that uncertain environment. Yeah. You know, there's been a lot going on in the broader.
It hasn't got any more certain since then.
It hasn't. I mean, when we spoke, you, I think in your models, the risk of the kind of Middle East escalation sat at around 30%.
Yeah.
I mean, looking at that geopolitical landscape today, have those probabilities shifted?
Yes, I think that they have shifted. So the major escalation point, I think, has died down a little bit, and you know we've reduced our probability in just in relation to that. However, irrespective of what's happening in terms of the ceasefire talks and the extent to which things are going to start to unwind, We haven't seen any ships come out of the Strait, and if they have, they've done it in the cover of darkness. So we haven't seen that free flow of activity. You know, we haven't seen the energy supply start to come through. So it's still very uncertain, and I think from a portfolio perspective, you know, making sure that we've got enough diversification in the portfolio is absolutely critical, but making sure also that we have a lot of stabilising influences in the portfolio as well, which is things like commodities and the rest of it.
I think when we spoke about hedging shocks last time, your team really championed that kind of all-weather commodity basket. Has that allocation done its job so far?
It's definitely done its job. Yeah. So, you know, and what's more important is we've been able to relay that to our clients. So one of the most important elements that we need to get right in portfolios is to basically say, there is a risk here. This is what the risk could be. We know that we live in a world where heightened geopolitical risk is something that we have to live with. Now, it's one thing to say that to a client, and it's another thing to actually put some strategies into a portfolio which actually do their job. So what we've been able to do throughout this crisis is actually give our clients comfort that we understand what's going to happen. You know, we can see that there was a 30% increase in the overall commodity spectrum, mainly driven by energy. But even last year, gold was a key driver of some of that sort of commodity exposure. But clients now understand that, okay, that this is the job that that sort of exposure plays in a portfolio. So has it done its job? Yes. And more importantly, I think our clients have actually come out thinking, actually, yeah, I understand why these things are in the portfolio, which makes these conversations so much easier.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I mean, you've mentioned that geopolitical risk is no longer episodic.
Yes.
it seems to be kind of constant. I mean, how do you factor this kind of ongoing baseline volatility into asset allocation? And I suppose secondary to that, do those conversations with clients ever get easier?
Conversations with clients will get easier the longer and the more trust that they put into the advisor relationship. Okay, that is absolutely critical. I think in terms of the reaction to geopolitical events is one of the most difficult things to actually gauge. Unfortunately, given my grey hair and everything, if I go back to, you know, the 80s and 90s and we start to work through the geopolitical events around the Kuwaiti war and all the tensions with Iraq at the time, that's a sort of situation where you could see the impact straight away, that markets were depressed because there was an economic shock caused by the energy spike that happened as a result. I look at it now and the markets, particularly in the US, it took 11 days for the S&P 500 to reach new highs post the Iranian war, starting on the 2nd of March. So understanding that, you know, we're still in an energy shock, but the markets are just doing something completely different. Are they complacent? I would say that they're driven by a particular reason, and that reason is just very, very topical at the moment, given the AI and the tech spend that we've been seeing. So we can't afford to ignore that. But the element of diversification in portfolios is, in this sort of light, absolutely critical. So knowing what sectors are going to perform very, very well and continue to perform well, and how do we put those stabilizer influences into a portfolio is really, really important as well. I mean, I get criticized because I liken it to my Pilates instructor, basically saying it's the small stabilizer muscles that you need to exercise that will help the large muscles actually do the job.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah, and I actually really liken it to the fact that our commodities exposure will give our portfolios a lot more stability in an event of a shock, and that's exactly what they've done. But at the same time, you know, equities and fixed income will do a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of the portfolio returns that we need to generate for our clients.
Mm-hmm. So the main point is diversification.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to the domestic picture.
Yes.
So you were quite taken aback again in April by the Bank of England sudden kind of dovish shift.
Yes.
In the spring. Might be quite punchy to say, but do you feel like they're kind of walking into a policy mistake?
I think it's very, very difficult now for the Bank of England to think about the domestic economic picture versus the inflationary pressures that an energy crisis brings. And how do they weigh up these different factors? We got to a point where, given the energy shock that did come through, that the market was starting to price in 4 rate hikes. From where we were previous to the Iranian war, it was essentially 2 rate cuts that we were going to see this year. That's now sort of, thankfully, gotten back to a point where we're expecting maybe 1 rate hike this year. But that is very dependent in terms of what the inflation picture looks like. But the Bank of England have been very clear in the fact that the economic conditions in the UK do look very sanguine, and that, you know, that they are going to be very cautious and understand their responsibility in terms of the monetary policy picture. Also, in light of this, two-year mortgage rates have ballooned. So over the course of this year, I think we've seen over 1% in terms of the effective tightening of mortgage rates on a two-year fixed. Now, that's done the work for the Bank of England in terms of trying to tighten up the economy a little bit more, maybe take some of the sort of pressure off them to raise base rates. But that said, yeah, they've still got to actually have a bit more of a hawkish tone to them. They are still scarred by the 2022-2023 inflation concerns that were coming through, and the fact that they were tightening rates far too late coming out of COVID. So they have those scars still fresh, and they're very cognizant of the fact of their responsibility of what they need to do going forward. They don't want to let the inflation genie out of the bottle again. And given that their inflation rates are running at, yes, they're sub 3 at the moment, but they're going to pop up well and truly above 3 as we sort of move forward. And it's all the second round effects that could come through. That's what they'll be looking for. Wages are coming off a little bit. They'll take a lot of comfort out of that, but it's all the other things.
I suppose we're also seeing this kind of desynchronized behavior of the central banks, right, with kind of the Fed, the BOE, the ECB all operating on different timelines. Does this then create a kind of trading whiplash?
Well, I mean, it is funny that you should mention that, because I would expect some of that whiplash, some of that volatility to come through in currency markets. Mm. And currency markets have been remarkably stable throughout this whole year. It's just phenomenal in terms of the fact that they've been able to sort of remain so stable. And a lot of that interest rate expectation, that differential that you're talking about, I think is definitely would have been reflected in those sort of currency markets. However, now I think we're in a position where central banks are, in terms of where expectations are, they are a little bit more coordinated. So everyone thought that the Fed were going to cut rates in light of everything else that was going on, because the whole Fed makeup was going to change, and now Warsh is going to has taken over. You know, he was seen as a sort of Trump appointee, and that he would sort of cut rates. I think he will come in with a very different view, given everything that's sort of going on. And now the expectations are that the Fed will actually potentially hike rates rather than cut rates. So much more aligned now to what the ECB are looking to do. They've well flagged that they're going to hike rates this month. The Bank of England might be a little bit more cautious in terms of hiking rates, given the delicate balance in our economy at the moment. And then you go to Australia, who have already hiked rates for, you know, three times, and came out with a very hawkish statement last night. So I think these are the elements that are essentially still playing out. I think the central banks are going to come down a path where they're going to be quite hawkish in terms of their tone, but how much do they actually put through, I think, is going to be the key. I think the markets will do the work for them, to be honest with you.
Moving to the equities side, I suppose, of the UK, I mean, in all the conversations, you'd say the UK remains historically cheap.
It does.
You've kind of lamented our lack of a domestic equity culture, I think, especially in comparison to the US. What kind of actual catalyst do you think it will take to unlock that?
I mean, that is a great question, because unlocking the wealth that we have in our country, which is currently sitting in, I would say, very conservative, defensive type strategies, even cash at bank, I think is one of the challenges that we do have in the UK and in Europe. I think the US equity culture that has flourished over the last 10 years has allowed them to really create that multiplier effect in the economy. And what do I mean by that is that people are willing to actually invest in a lot of these companies, you know, and that money then gets deployed in high productivity based solutions that roll out and actually see the economic benefit coming through for the country. So the UK at the moment, and the government are trying everything, well, maybe not everything that they can do, but they understand the problem that, you know, we don't have an equity culture here. We don't have an investment culture. We have a savings culture, but a lot of that savings culture is essentially, yes, let's just keep money in the bank, let's be conservative. And I totally understand that, because a lot of that wealth has been made up through, you know, a lot of business owners who have worked extremely hard to sort of get to that sort of point. And maybe they've sold their business and, yeah, they're just uncertain in terms of what the future looks like. I think that there is a massive education piece that we as wealth managers can actually provide to the broader marketplace, and with the regulator's support, you know, we'll be able to sort of do that. And I think that that's going to be an important piece. But it does highlight the fact that we need that investment in the economy in order for, you know, some of that sort of UK policies to really have a benefit to actually economic growth, employment growth, and then how that sort of starts to mirror in some way, shape or form. Not that I would want to mirror everything that's happening in the US, but, you know, to really try to get that multiplier effect happening in the economy.
Well, I think that's a really interesting point, because obviously we're seeing the industry, you know, really rally to the cause, and we've seen the retail investment campaign, which is backed by a lot of, you know, people in the industry. But I suppose that it really is focused on the kind of education and maybe just even awareness of investing, and that's an option. But I think, you know, we've discussed the education piece and the changing culture is no small task, and you know, can move at a glacial pace. So I just wonder if we need that kind of more, we need something harder that will change the underlying things that we can achieve that.
Yeah, and it's hard to, I mean, things do move at a glacial pace. And if you're trying to change culture, that's a generational thing. Mm. So influencing the next generation of wealth is an imperative under that sort of scenario. And I think that those are some of the things. How can we appeal more to sort of building the trust with a younger sort of client base, and then bringing them and educating them in terms of what the journey looks like around a portfolio construction? There are definitely elements that are, you know, if I take my son, for instance, you know, he would love to sort of do his own thing and, you know, look at his device and basically buy a whole lot of stocks and try to sort of do it that way. So there is an element of trading, which I think is starting to sort of come through. But the element of investing for your future, That becomes, well, what are the professionals doing? How can we create even more trust with our clients, but also our clients' next generation? So I think that those are some of the sort of key things that, you know, certainly as a business we will focus on.
Mm-hmm. Taking maybe a step back, that does seem to be an area of concern, for, I think, for a lot of people in the industry. But is there anything else that is concerning you about markets? Maybe if we go globally now, at the moment.
I do feel that the energy crisis, we are not on any sort of exit path in relation to the energy crisis at the moment. I think we're still on an escalatory path. And the reason I say that, even though that there could be a ceasefire and all those sorts of things, that we will see real refined demand destruction coming as a result of the fact that there is just not enough energy in the places that need it in order to sort of maintain their growth profile. And this is where I feel that energy security is definitely going to be one of the key determining factors for what technology advancements we'll be able to make in the future. And I think China are well placed in that sort of space. And give it 10 years and they'll probably be in a supreme position over the US. I think, so thinking through that dynamic, how do we put that into portfolios? You don't want to go headlong into it, but it's making sure that we build appropriate positions in portfolios for that longer term theme that's coming through. But from a concerning perspective, yeah, we are in a world of deglobalization. You know, that is going to involve resource protection or securing resource where they possibly can.
I'm thinking about the energy transition. Are we awake to that enough? You know, are we as the industry cognizant of how much of a change that could have?
I think it's difficult because if I look at the UK situation, just to update the grid is a hugely expensive exercise. The government doesn't have enough money to actually sort of fulfill that task. It has to use private partnerships as well in order for that to happen. I think there is an appetite, or there is certainly knowledge to do it. I think at the moment, you know, have we got investors lining up to actually update the grid for us? I don't think so. And I think with the policy divide that we're seeing between the US and their removal of environmental policies to Europe, where, you know, we are trying to strengthen our environmental policies, yeah, that sort of disconnect makes it very difficult. But at the same time, I think, you know, we are going to be in a position where we have to rely on many more renewable sources in order to sort of meet the energy needs of a technology age that at the moment we just don't have enough energy to sustain going forward. So that's why we go up into space, and that's why space is getting all the sort of attention at the moment. But yeah, these are some of the themes that are essentially coming through. So it's really exciting, very exciting, but it's also, you know, let's try to remove the hype and let's have a look at what that commerciality could look like.
Okay, well, I think that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was great.
And a big thank you to our audience for tuning into this episode of The Wealth Show. We'll see you next time.
Today is VE Day. The boys
the newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.